One cabin had been left empty deliberately. And it had to be 10. Palmgren was the very last cabin on the ship. There were no cabins beyond it from which to see something floating past, disappearing in the foam of the ship's wake. Someone had died. I was sure of it. Just not that girl. But then, who? I tossed and turned in the darkness, listening for any sounds above the roar of the engine, and trying to answer the questions churning uneasily inside. My brain felt fogged and thick, but I kept coming back to that question. Who? Who had died? Chapter 24. When I woke next, it was to the same metallic click I'd heard before, and the lights flickered on. They strobed for a moment, the warming hum of the low-energy bulbs audible above the engine sound and mingling with the whining in my ears. I jumped up, my heart racing in my chest, and knocked over something on the floor beside the bed as I gazed wildly around. I had missed my chance. God damn it, I had missed my chance again. I had to find out what was going on here, what they intended to do with me, why they were keeping me shut up. How long had I been here? Was it daytime now, or was this just the time that it suited the girl, or whoever my captor was, to turn the electricity back on? I tried to count back. I had been hit in the early hours of Tuesday morning. At the very least, it was Wednesday morning now, possibly later. It felt as if I'd been here longer than 24 hours, much longer. I went to the bathroom to splash water on my face. It was as I was drying myself that a wave of vertigo washed over me, making my head reel and the whole room shift and shudder. I had the sudden sensation of falling, and I put out my hand to steady myself against the doorframe, shutting my eyes against the sensation of plummeting very far and very fast into black water. At last, the sensation receded, and I made my way back to the bunk, where I sat and put my head between my knees, feeling my skin shiver with cold and hot. Had the ship moved? It was hard to know what was dizziness and what was the movement of the waves so far down beneath the decks. The movement of the ship felt very different down here. Not so much a rhythmic rise and fall, but a sluggish roll that mingled with the constant roar of the engine to give a strange, hypnotic feeling. There was a tray beside the bed, with a Danish pastry and a bowl of slopped muesli. That must have been what I knocked when I jumped up out of sleep. I picked it up and forced myself to take a spoonful. I wasn't hungry, but I'd eaten nothing but a few meatballs since Monday night. If I was going to get out of here, I would need to fight. And to fight, I needed to eat. What I really wanted, though, was not food. It was my pills. I wanted them with a fierce, physical longing that I remembered from the last time I tried to stop taking them. Only this time, I knew that things wouldn't get better without them, as I had kept telling myself last time. They were going to get worse. "If you're around to see it," said a nasty little voice in my head. The muesli stuck in my throat, and suddenly I couldn't swallow. I longed for the girl from the cabin to come back. A vivid, luxuriantly violent image flashed across my brain, me grabbing her hair the way she'd grabbed mine, smashing her cheekbone against the sharp metal edge of the bunk, watching the blood flow, the way it would smell sharp and raw in the confined, airless cabin. I remembered again the blood on the veranda, the way it had smeared across the glass, and I wished with a powerful, vicious longing that it had been hers. "I hate you," I thought. I swallowed against the pain in my throat, forcing the soggy, half-chewed muesli down. I took another spoonful, my fingers shaking as I conveyed it to my mouth. I hate you so much. I hope you do drown. The muesli felt like cement, choking me as I tried to swallow it. But I forced it down again and again until the bowl was half empty. I did not know if I could do this, but I had to try. I picked up the thin melamine tray and smacked it on the metal edge of the bunk. It bounced back and I only just flinched out of the way in time. I had a sudden, sharp flashback to the burglary, the door smacking into my cheekbone, and had to shut my eyes for a moment and steady myself on the bunk. I didn't try that again. Instead, I leaned the tray on the metal edge, put my knee on the nearest side, and all my weight on my hands on the far edge. Then I pushed down. The tray did nothing at first, and I pressed harder. Then it snapped in half with a noise like a gunshot, sending me sprawling onto the bed. But I had what I'd been aiming for. Two pieces of plastic, not quite razor sharp, but each with an edge formidable enough to do some damage. I picked up each piece, weighing them in my hand for the best way to hold them, and then, holding the one that felt like the most intimidating weapon, I walked across to the door and crouched against the wall next to the frame. And I waited. It seemed to last for hours that day. Once or twice I felt my eyes sliding shut, my body trying to shut down amid the exhausting flood of adrenaline and fear, but I jerked them back open. "Stay with it, low." I began to count, not from panic this time, but just to keep myself awake. 1, 2, 3, 4. When I got to 1,000, I changed and began to count in French. 1, 2, 3, then in twos. I played games in my head. Fizzbuzz, that children's game where you say fizz for every 5 or multiple of 5, and buzz for every 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, fizz. My hands were shaking. 6, buzz. 8, 9, 10. No, wait, that should have been fizz. I shook my head impatiently, rubbed my aching arms, and started again. 1, 2. And then I heard it. A noise in the corridor. A door slamming. I caught my breath. They were coming closer. My heart began to race. The pit of my stomach clenched. A key in the lock. And then the door cracked cautiously open, and I pounced. Her. She saw me leap towards the gap and tried to close it, but I was too quick for her. I thrust my arm into the gap and it slammed onto my forearm hard. I screamed with pain, but the door bounced back and I was able to wedge half my body into the gap, stabbing at her grappling arm with the jagged edge of the broken tray. But instead of falling backwards, as I'd anticipated, she rushed forwards into the room, thumping me back against the plastic wall, the tray cutting painfully into my arm. I pulled myself up, blood dripping down the back of my hand, but she was faster. She lunged at the door, locked it, and then stood with her back to it, the key clenched in her fist. "Let me go." It came out like the growl of an animal, not quite human. She shook her head. Her back was to the door and she had my blood on her face and she was scared, but kind of exhilarated too. I could see it in her eyes. She had the upper hand and she knew it. "I'll kill you," I said. I meant it. I held up the tray stained with my own blood. "I'll cut your throat."
"You couldn't kill me,"
she said, and her voice was just as I remembered it, with a kind of scornful defiance behind her words. "Look at you. You can barely stand up, you poor bitch." "Why?" I said, and there was a note in my voice that sounded like a whining little child. "Why are you doing this?"
"Because you made us," she hissed, suddenly furious. "You wouldn't stop digging, would you? No matter how much I tried to warn you off. If you just kept your mouth shut about what you saw in that bloody cabin..."
"What did I see?" I said, but she shook her head, her lip curling.
"God, you must think I'm even dumber than I look. Do you actually want to die?"
I shook my head.
"Good. What do you want, then?"
"I want to get out of here," I said. I sat down on the bunk abruptly, not sure if my legs would hold me much longer. She shook her head vehemently this time, and I saw that flicker of fear in her eyes again.
"He'd never let me."
"He?" The word sent a prickle through me, the first concrete evidence that someone upstairs had been helping her. Who was he? But I didn't dare ask, not now. There was something more important I needed first.
"My pills, then. Let me have my pills."
She looked at me appraisingly.
"The ones you had by the sink?"
"I might be able to do that.
Why'd you want them?"
"They're antidepressants," I said bitterly.
"They have..."
"You shouldn't withdraw from them too fast."
"Oh."
There was sudden comprehension on her face.
"That's why you look so bad. I couldn't work it out. I thought I'd hit your head too hard."
"Okay, I can do that. But you have to promise me something in return." "What?"
"No more trying to attack me. These are for good behavior, right?"
"All right." She straightened, picked up the plate and bowl, and held out her hand for the shards of tray. I hesitated for a moment, and then handed them over.
"I'm going to unlock the door now," she said. "But don't do anything stupid. There's another door outside this one, operated by a code. You won't get very far. So no silly buggers, all right?"
"All right," I said reluctantly. After she'd gone, I sat on the bench, staring into space, thinking about what she'd said. He. She did have an accomplice on board. And that one word meant I could rule out Tina, Chloe, Anne, and two-thirds of the staff. Who was he? I ticked them off in my head. Nielsen, Bulmer, Cole, Ben, Archer. In the less likely column, I put Owen White, Alexander, and the crew and stewards. My mind circled the possibilities, but the one factor I kept coming back to was the spa and the stop digging message. There was only one man who had been down there. One man who could have written that sign. Ben. I had to stop focusing on motives. Why was an unsolvable question that I just didn't have enough information to answer. But the how? There were very few people on board with the opportunity to write that message. There was one functioning entrance to the spa, and Ben was the only male who I was certain had used it. So many things made sense. His quickness to undermine my story to Nielsen, the fact that he, alone of everyone on board, had tried to get into my cabin on that last night, and knew that I was locked in the bathroom, making it possible to steal my phone. The fact that his cabin was on the other side of the empty one, yet he'd heard nothing and seen nothing. The fact that he'd lied about his alibi, playing poker. And the fact that he had tried so hard to stop me from pushing on with the investigation. The clicking of the puzzle pieces into place should have given me satisfaction, but they didn't. Because what use were answers to me down here? I needed to get out. Chapter 25. I was lying on my side, staring at the cream melamine wall, when the knock came. "Come in," I said dully, and then almost laughed at myself for the stupidity of social niceties in a situation like this. What did it matter if I said come in when they would do as they liked regardless?
"It's me,"
said the voice outside the door. "No more shit with the trays, okay? Or this'll be the last pill you get off me, right?" "Okay," I said. I was trying not to sound too eager, but I sat up, pulling the thin blanket around myself. I hadn't used the shower since I got here, and I smelled of sweat and fear. The door cracked open cautiously, and the girl pushed a tray of food through the bottom with her foot, and then slipped through the gap, locking it behind her. "Here you go," she said. She held out her hand. On her palm was a single white tablet.
"One?"
I said incredulously.
"One. Maybe I can bring you a couple more tomorrow, if you behave."
I had just given her the best blackmail weapon ever. But I nodded and took the pill from her palm. From her pocket she pulled a book, one of mine, in fact, from my room. The Bell Jar. Not what I'd have chosen under the circumstances, but it was better than nothing.
"I thought you might like something to read. You might be going a bit nuts with nothing to do."
Her eyes strayed to the pill, and then she added,
"No offence."
"Thanks," I said. She turned to go, and I said,
"Wait. Yeah?"
Suddenly, I wasn't sure how to ask what I wanted to ask. I clenched my hand around the pill in my palm.
Shit. What's going to happen to me?
Her face changed at that. Something guarded came over her expression, like a curtain falling across a window.
"That's not up to me."
"Who is it up to? Ben?" She gave a derisory snort at that.
"Enjoy."
As she turned to leave, she caught sight of herself in the little mirror on the back of the ensuite door.
"Fuck! I've got blood on my face. Why didn't you say? If he knows you attacked me..."
She went into the little toilet to splash and wipe her face. But it wasn't just the blood she wiped away. When she came out, I froze. With that one simple act, I realized who she was. In wiping away the blood, she had wiped both her eyebrows clean off, leaving a smooth, skull-like forehead that was instantly, unbearably recognizable. The woman in cabin 10 was Anne Bulmer. Chapter 26. I was too stunned to say anything. I just sat there, open-mouthed with shock. The girl looked from me back to her reflection in the ensuite mirror and realized what she'd done. An expression of annoyance crossed her face for a moment, but then she seemed to shrug it off and stalked out of the room, letting the door swing shut behind her. I heard a key scrape in the lock, and then another door bang further away. Anne Bulmer. Anne Bulmer? It seemed impossible that she could be the same gaunt, grey, prematurely aged woman I'd seen and spoken to. And yet, her face was unmistakable. The same dark eyes, the same high, jutting cheekbones. The only thing I couldn't understand was how I'd missed it before. If I hadn't seen her mid-transformation, I would never have believed how much her hair and the delicately penciled eyebrows changed her face. Without them, she looked oddly featureless and smooth. It was impossible not to think of death and illness when you looked at that bone-pale sweep of skin, and the scarf tied tight around her skull only emphasized that fragility, painfully underscoring the lines of her neck and the shape of the bones beneath. But her sleek black brows and the vibrant mass of dark hair changed all that beyond recognition. With it she became young, healthy, alive. I realized that when I'd spoken to Anne Bulmer before, I had been so mesmerized by the trappings of her illness that I'd never really looked at the woman beneath. I had tried not to look, in fact. I had just seen the distinctive draping clothes, the missing eyebrows, the distractingly smooth skull beneath those delicate scarves. The hair must be a wig. I had no doubt about that. There was no room under those thin silk scarves for thick, dark tresses. But was she sick? Well, dying? Faking? It didn't make sense. I tried to think back to what Ben had told me. 4 years of chemo and radiotherapy. Could you really fake that? Even with private doctors in your pay and a jet-setting lifestyle that enabled you to hop from one health system to another every few months. Maybe. At least this explained one thing, how she had got on board, and what had happened to her after that splash in the night. She'd simply pulled off her wig, put on her scarf, and resumed her life as Anne Bulmer. It also explained how she had access to every part of the ship, to the pass keys and the staff areas, and this secret locked vault down in the belly of the boat. When your husband was the owner, nothing was out of bounds. But the thing that puzzled me most was why. Why dress up in a wig and a Pink Floyd t-shirt and spend the afternoon hanging out in an empty cabin? What was she doing there? And if it was so secret, why answer the door at all? As the last question ran through my head, I had a sudden flash of myself knocking on the door. 1, 2, 3, pause, and another bang, and the way the door had been snatched open as if someone had been waiting for that final knock. It was an odd knock, idiosyncratic, the kind of knock you might use if you were arranging a code. Was it possible I had completely accidentally stumbled on a prearranged signal for the woman in the cabin, Anne Bulmer, to open the door? If only I'd just knocked twice, like any normal person, or even once, I would never have known she was there, never have put myself in this position where I had to be locked up, silenced. Silenced. It was an uncomfortable thought, and the words stuck in my head, reverberating there like an echo. I had to be silenced. But silenced for how long? Locked up here until, what, some agreed deadline had passed? Or silenced permanently? Supper was white fish in a sort of cream sauce with boiled potatoes. It was cold, congealing around the edges, but I was hungry. Before I ate, I looked at the pill in my hand, wondering what to do. It was half my normal dose. I could take the whole pill now, or I could split it and start building up a reserve in case. But in case of what? I could hardly escape, and if Anne decided to stop dispensing the pills, I would run out long before she took pity on me. In the end, I gulped down the whole thing, reasoning that I had a deficit to make up. I could start biting them in half tomorrow, if it seemed important. I felt better almost immediately, though I knew, logically, that it couldn't be the pills. They didn't absorb that fast, and the effect took a while to build up in your system. Whatever relief I was experiencing was completely placebo-based. At this point, though, I didn't care. I would take what I could get. Then I started picking at the lukewarm supper. As I sat on the bunk, chewing the tepid, gluey potato slowly in an effort to make it less unappealing, I tried to rearrange the pieces of the puzzle I had assembled so painstakingly inside my head. I knew now what that derisive snort meant. Poor Ben. I felt a rush of guilt that I had been so quick to judge him. And then another rush, this time of anger. I'd been so focused on Anne's chance mention of a male accomplice that it had never occurred to me that Anne herself might have been the one to run quickly down the spa stairs while her varnish was supposed to be drying and scrawl those words. Stupid, stupid Lo. But stupid Ben, too. If he hadn't spent so many years belittling my feelings, and if he hadn't been so eager to spill the beans to Nielsen instead of supporting my story, then I might not have been so quick to jump to conclusions. I knew now who he was. It must be Richard Bulmer. He owned the boat, and of all the men on the ship, I could imagine him planning and carrying out a murder better than anyone else. Certainly better than fat, fussy Alexander or the lumbering bear-like Nielsen. Except that no murder had taken place. Why did I have to keep reminding myself of that fact? Why was it so hard to grasp? Because you're here, I thought. Because whatever you saw, whatever happened in that cabin, it was important enough for them to lock you up here and prevent you from going to see the police at Trondheim. What had happened? It must be something so high stakes that they simply couldn't afford to let me talk about it. Was it smuggling? Were they throwing something overboard to an accomplice? "It'll be you next, you stupid bitch," said the voice inside my head, and an image of myself falling through deep water shot through me, like an electric shock deep in my skull. I winced and gritted my teeth, forcing myself to swallow another glutinous mouthful of potato. The ship heaved, and nausea swirled around in the pit of my stomach. What was going to happen to me? There were only two possibilities. They were going to let me go at some point, or they were going to kill me. And somehow, the first one didn't seem very likely anymore. I knew so much. I knew about Anne. I knew she wasn't nearly as ill as she pretended, and they could not afford for me to get out and tell my story, a story of kidnap, imprisonment, and bodily harm. Though would anyone believe me? I touched my fingers to my cheek, where the blood was still caked from where she'd whacked me into the doorframe. I felt suddenly gross, dirty and sweaty and blood-smeared. Anne, judging by her previous timings, wouldn't be back for hours. There wasn't much I could do to improve my lot, stuck in this 2-meter coffin, but at least I could keep myself clean. The jet was nothing like the one in my suite upstairs. Even turned up full, it was a tepid trickle. But I stood underneath it for so long I felt my fingers wrinkle into mush. The clotted blood on my hand dissolved into the water, and I shut my eyes and felt the warmth pour through me, seeping into my muscles. When I climbed out, I felt better, more like myself, washed clean of some of the fear and violence that had marked the last few days. It was putting my clothes back on that made me realize how far I'd sunk. They stank, not to put too fine a point on it, and were stained with blood and sweat. I lay down on the bunk and shut my eyes, listening to the steady thrum of the engine and wondering where we were. It was Wednesday night, or maybe even Thursday morning now. From what I could remember, we had only a little over 24 hours of this trip left. And then what? When the boat got into Bergen on Friday morning, the other passengers would leave, and with them would go my last hope of someone realizing what had happened. For 24 hours, I was probably safe. But after that... Oh, God. But I couldn't think about that. I pressed my hands into my eyes, listened to the blood roaring in my head. What should I do? What could I do? If Anne were telling the truth, hurting her wouldn't achieve anything. There was another locked door the other side of this one, and very likely other codes on the exits. For a minute I wondered, if I got out into the corridor, could I find and smash a fire alarm before she caught up with me? But it seemed like too long a shot. From what I'd seen of her strength and quickness, I was unlikely to get that far. No, my best chance was simple. I had to get Anne on my side. But how? What did I actually know about her? I tried to think. Her fantastic wealth, her lonely upbringing, trailed around the boarding schools of Europe. It was no wonder it had taken me so long to make the connection. The rake, thin, sad-eyed woman in her grey silk wraps and designer headscarf. Yes, somehow that fitted with what I'd been told. But I could not make one word of what Ben had said connect with the girl in the Pink Floyd T-shirt, with her mocking dark eyes and cheap mascara. It was like there were two Annes. Same height, same weight, but that was where the similarity ended. And then, something clicked. Two Annes. Two women. The grey silk robe that matched her eyes. I opened my eyes and swung my legs over the side of the bunk, groaning with my own stupidity. Of course, if I hadn't been half dead with fear and panic and the pain in my head, I would have seen it. How could I not have thought of it? Of course there were two Annes. Anne Bulmer was dead. Had been since the night we left England. The girl in the Pink Floyd T-shirt was very much alive, and had been impersonating her ever since. Same height, same weight, same broad cheekbones. It was only the eyes that didn't match, and they had taken a calculated risk that no one would remember the features of a woman they'd barely met. No one on board knew Anne before the trip. Richard had even told Cole not to take any photographs of her, for Christ's sake. Now I understand why. It wasn't to protect a woman self-conscious about her appearance. It was so there would be no compromising photographs for his wife's friends and family to puzzle over afterwards. I shut my eyes, my fingers gripping my hair so hard that it hurt, tugging painfully on my scalp, trying to work out what must have happened. Richard Bulmer, it must have been him, had smuggled the woman in cabin 10 on board somehow. She was in that cabin before the rest of us ever came on the ship. The day we set sail, she had been waiting for the word, for instruction from Richard, to clear her cabin and get ready. I thought back to what I'd seen over her shoulder. A silk robe strewn across the bed, makeup, veet in the bathroom, waxing strips. Christ! How could I have been so stupid? She had been shaving and ripping off her body hair, ready to impersonate a woman with cancer. But instead of Richard with his prearranged knock, I had come along, inadvertently given the signal, and she'd seen me instead. What the hell must she have thought? I replayed again the fright and irritation in her face as she tried to shut the door, and I'd stopped her. She'd been desperate to get rid of me, but trying to act as unsuspiciously as possible. Far better that I just remembered a strange woman lending a mascara than started telling tales of a fellow guest slamming the door in my face. And it had nearly worked. It had so nearly worked. Did she tell Richard when he came? I couldn't be sure, but I thought not. He had seemed so normal at that first night's dinner. The perfect host. And besides, it was her blunder, and he didn't look like the kind of man you want to confess a mistake to. More likely, she just crossed her fingers and hoped to get away with it. Then she had packed her things, cleared the room, and waited. After drinks that first night, the real Anne, somehow, had been taken to cabin 10. Was she alive? Lured there by some cock-and-bull story? Or was she already dead? Either way, it didn't really matter, because the end result was the same. While Richard was back in Lars's cabin establishing his alibi with an uninterrupted poker game, the woman in cabin 10 had bundled Anne overboard and hoped that the body would never be found. And they would have got away with it if I, frightened and traumatized from the burglary, hadn't heard the splash and jumped to a conclusion that was so wrong it was almost completely right. So who was she? Who was this girl who had hit me and fed me and locked me up here like an animal? I had no idea. But I knew one thing. She was my best hope of getting out of here alive. Chapter 27. All that night I lay awake, trying to work out what I should do. Judah and my parents would not be expecting me home until Friday and would have no reason to suspect anything was wrong until then. But the other passengers must think that I hadn't returned to the ship. Would they have raised the alarm? Or had Bulmer given them some story to explain my disappearance? Unavoidably detained in Trondheim, perhaps. Decided to return home unexpectedly. I wasn't sure. I tried to think who might be concerned enough to ask questions. I had little hope of Cole, Chloe, or most of the others making a fuss. They didn't know me. They had no contact details for any of my family. They would very likely accept whatever Bulmer told them. Ben, he knew me well, enough to know that an early morning flit from Trondheim without a word wasn't in character, but I wasn't sure. Under normal circumstances, perhaps he'd have contacted Judah or my parents with his concerns, but the way I had left things with him wasn't exactly normal circumstances. I had all but accused him of being complicit in a murder, and aside from his justifiable anger, he probably wouldn't be surprised at my disappearing off the ship without a word of goodbye. Out of the other guests, Tina seemed like my best bet, and I was crossing my fingers that she would contact Rowan when I failed to return. But it seemed very slim odds to hang my life on. No, I had to take matters into my own hands. By the time morning came, I hadn't slept, but I knew what I had to do. And when the knock came, I was ready. "Come in," I said. The door cracked, and the girl put her head cautiously around the doorframe. She saw me sitting quietly on the bed, washed and clean, holding the book in my lap. "Hey," I said. She put down the tray of food on the floor. She was dressed as Anne this time, wearing a headscarf, her eyebrows not penciled in, but she didn't move like Anne. She moved like the girl I'd seen before, dumping the tray down impatiently and straightening up with none of the meditative grace she'd shown when impersonating Richard's wife. "Hey yourself," she said, and her voice was different too, the crystalline consonants elided and blurred. "You finished with that?" She nodded at the book. "Yes. Can you swap it for another one?" "Yeah, I guess. What do you want?" "I don't mind. Anything. You choose." "Okay." She held out her hand for the bell jar, and I handed it over, then steeled myself for what I had to do next. "I'm sorry," I said, awkwardly, "about the tray." She gave a smile at that, a flash of straight white teeth, a glint of mischief in her dark eyes. "That's all right. I don't blame you. I'd have done the same. You've got a rubber one this time, though. Fool me once and all that." I looked down at the breakfast lying on the floor. The brittle melamine tray had been replaced by one made of thick, grippy plastic, the kind you serve drinks on in bars. "I can't complain, I guess." I forced a smile. "I earned it." "Your pill's on the saucer. Remember, good behaviour, yeah?" I nodded, and she turned to leave. I gulped, I had to stop her, say something, anything that might prevent me from being condemned to another day and night here alone. "What's your name?" I said, desperately. She turned back, her face suspicious. "What?" "I know you're not Anne." I remembered about the eyes. On the first night, Anne had grey eyes. You don't. Other than that, it's very convincing. You're a really good actress, you know. Her face went completely blank, and for a minute I thought that she was going to slam out of the room and leave me here for another 12 hours. I felt like a fisherman reeling in a huge fish on a delicate line, my muscles tense with the effort, but trying not to jerk or show the strain. "If I've got it wrong," I began cautiously. "Shut up," she said, fierce as a lioness. Her face was completely transformed, savage with anger, her dark eyes full of rancor and distrust. "I'm sorry," I said humbly. "I didn't... Look, does it matter? I'm not going anywhere. Who would I tell?" "Fuck!" she said bitterly. "You're digging your grave. Do you get that?" I nodded. But I had known that for a few days now. Whatever the girl tried to tell herself, whatever I tried to tell myself, there was only one way I was leaving this room. "I don't think Richard will let me leave," I said. "You know that, right? So name or no name, it doesn't really matter." Her face beneath the expensive headscarf was white. When she spoke, her voice was bitter. "You fucked it all up! Why couldn't you leave well enough alone?" "I was trying to help," I said. I didn't mean it to sound the way it came out, but in the little room it sounded frighteningly loud. I swallowed and spoke more quietly. "I was trying to help you. Don't you get that?" "Why?" she said. It was half a question, half a cry of frustration. "Why? You barely knew me. Why did you have to keep digging?" "Because I knew what it was like to be you. I know what it's like to wake up in the night, afraid for your life." "But that's not me," she snarled. She stalked across the little cabin. Close up, I could see that her eyebrows had just the faintest brush of regrowth. "It was never me." "It will be, though," I said, holding her gaze so she couldn't look away. I couldn't afford to release her from the knowledge of what she was doing. "When Richard's got Anne's money, what do you think his next move will be?" "Making himself safe."
"Shut up! You have no idea what you're talking about! He's a good man! He's in love with me!"
I stood up, level with her. Our eyes were locked, our faces just inches apart in the tiny space.
"That's bullshit, and you know it," I said.
My hands were shaking. If this went wrong, she might lock the door and never come back. But I had to make her face up to the reality of the situation, both for my sake and hers. If she walked away now, we were very likely both dead. "If he was in love with you, he wouldn't be beating you up and forcing you to dress up as his dead wife. What do you think this charade is all about? Being with you? It's not about you. If it was, he'd have got a divorce and walked off into the sunset with you. But she'd have taken her money with her. She was heir to a billion-pound dynasty. Those kinds of people don't risk marriage without a prenup."
"Shut up!"
She put her hands over her ears, shaking her head.
"You don't know what you're talking about. Neither of us wanted to be in this situation."
"Really? You think it's coincidence he fell in love with someone who bears a startling resemblance to Anne?
He planned this from the beginning. You're just a means to an end.
You know nothing about it, the girl snarled.
She turned away from me, walked to where the window would have been if I had one, and back. There was nothing of Anne's weary serenity in her expression now. It was naked fear and fury. All the money, without the controlling wife. I think he had that carrot waved in front of his nose by Anne's illness, and suddenly he found he liked the idea. A future without Anne, but with the money. And when the doctors gave her the all clear, he didn't want to let go of it. Is that right? And then he saw you, and a plan started to form. Where did he pick you up? A bar? No, wait. I remembered the photo on Cole's camera. It was at his club, right?
You know nothing about it, the girl shouted. Nothing!
And before I could say anything else, she turned on her heel, unlocked the door with a trembling hand, and slammed out of the room, the bell jar still clutched beneath her arm. The door banged shut behind her, and I heard her keys scraping shakily in the lock. Then further away, another bang, and then it was still. I sat back on the bunk. Had I made her doubt Richard enough to put her trust in me? Or was she going upstairs right now to tell him this whole conversation? There was only one way to find out, and that was to wait. But as the hours slipped away and she didn't come back, I started to wonder how long that wait would be. And when she didn't reappear with supper, and hunger began to claw at my stomach, I began to suspect I'd made a horrible mistake.
Chapter 28. I lay for a long time staring at the bunk above me, running over the conversation in my head and trying to work out if I'd just made the worst mistake of my life. I'd gambled on establishing some kind of bond with the girl, forcing her to face up to what she was doing, and it was starting to look like I'd failed. The hours dragged on and still no one came. My hunger grew more and more distracting. I wished I hadn't given her back the book. There was nothing in the cabin I could distract myself with. I began to think about solitary confinement, how prisoners went slowly crazy, heard voices, begged for release. At least the girl had left the electricity on, although I wasn't sure if it was an act of mercy. She had been so furious when she left the room, she'd probably have switched it off just to punish me. More likely, she'd just forgotten. But that small fact, the idea that I could choose my environment even in such a minor way, helped. I showered again and licked the dried croissant jam off the plate. I lay on the bed and shut my eyes and tried to remember things. The layout of the house I grew up in. The plot of Little Women. The colour of Jude's... But no. I pushed that away. I could not think of Judah. Not here. It would break me. In the end, more as a way of taking charge of the situation than because I really thought it would help, I turned out the light and lay, staring into the blackness, trying to sleep. I'm not sure if I did sleep. I dozed, I guess. Hours passed, or seemed to. No one came, but at some point in the long darkness I was jerked awake and sat up, my pulse spiking, trying to fathom what was different. A noise? A presence in the dark? My heart was thumping as I slipped out of bed and felt my way by touch to the door. But when I flicked on the light, nothing was different. The cabin was empty. The tiny ensuite as bare as ever. I held my breath, listening, but there were no footsteps in the corridor outside, no voices or movements, not a sound disturbed the quiet. And then I realized. The quiet. That was what had woken me. The engine had stopped. I tried to count the days on my fingers,
and although I couldn't be sure, I was fairly certain it must now be Friday the 25th. And that meant the ship had arrived at its last port, Bergen, where we were due to disembark and catch planes back to London. The passengers would be leaving. And then I'd be alone. The thought brought panic rushing through my veins. The idea that they were so close, sleeping most likely just a few feet above my head, and yet there was nothing, nothing I could do to make them hear. And soon they would pack their cases and leave, and I would be alone, in a boat-shaped coffin. The thought was too much to bear. Without thinking, I grabbed the bowl that had held yesterday's breakfast and banged it against the ceiling as hard as I could. "Help!" I screamed. "Can anyone hear me? I'm trapped! Please, please help!" I stopped, panting, listening, hoping desperately that with the sound of the engine no longer masking my cries, someone might hear. There was no answering thump, no muffled shout filtering back through the floors. But I heard something. It was a metallic grinding, as if something was scraping the outside of the hull. Had someone heard? I held my breath, trying to still my heart, which was beating so loud it threatened to drown out the faint sounds from outside the ship. Was someone coming? The grinding came again. I felt the ship's side shudder, and I realized suddenly what it was. The gangway was being lowered. The passengers were disembarking. "Help me!" I screamed, and I banged again. Only now I was noticing the way the plastic ceiling deadened and absorbed the sound. "Help me! It's me! Lo! I'm here! I'm on the boat!" No answer, just the breath tearing in my throat, my blood in my ears. "Anyone? Please! Please help!" I put my hands to the wall, feeling the thumps against the gangway being transmitted down through the hull and into my hands. The impact of goods trolleys and luggage and departing feet. I could feel all this, but I could not hear it. I was deep below the water, and they were up above where any faint vibrations that I could make with my plastic bowl would be drowned out by the sound of the wind and the screech of the gulls and the voices of their fellow passengers. I let the bowl fall from my hands to the floor, where it bounced and rolled across the thin carpet. And then I dropped to the bed and crouched there, my arms wrapped around my head pressed into my knees, and I began to weep, great choking tears of fear and desperation. I had been afraid before. I'd been scared half out of my wits, but I had never despaired, and it was despair that I was feeling now. As I knelt on the thin, sagging mattress, sobbing into my knees, pictures passed through my head. Judah reading the paper, my mother doing the crossword, her tongue between her teeth. My father mowing the lawn on a Sunday, humming tunelessly. I would have given anything to see one of them in this room just for a moment, just to tell them I was alive and loving them. But all I could think of was them waiting for my return, and their despair as I didn't arrive. And finally, the endless sentence of waiting. Waiting without hope for someone who would never come. From Judah Lewis to Judah Lewis, Pamela Crewe, Alan Blacklock. BCC, 38 recipients. Sent Tuesday the 29th of September. Subject, Lo, an update.
Dear all, I'm very sorry to be sending this news in an email, but I'm sure you'll understand that these last few days have been very difficult, and we've had trouble responding to everyone's concern and inquiries. Up until now, we didn't really have anything concrete to share, and this has resulted in a lot of hurtful speculation on social media. However, we have now received some news. Unfortunately, it's not what we were hoping for. Alo's parents, Pam and Alan, have asked me to send this update to her close friends and immediate family on behalf of them as well as myself, as some details seem to have been leaked to the press already, and we didn't want anyone to find this out from the internet. There is no easy way to say this. Early this morning, Scotland Yard asked me to identify some photographs they received from the Norwegian police team handling the case. They were photographs of clothes and the garments Arlo's. I recognized them immediately. The boots in particular are vintage and very distinctive and unmistakably hers. We are obviously in pieces at this discovery, but we are holding on and waiting to find out what the police can tell us. This is all we know at present, as the body is still in Norway. In the meantime, we would please ask you to use your discretion in talking to the media. If you have anything to add to the investigation, I can give you the name of the officers at Scotland Yard handling the case at the UK end. We also have a family liaison officer who is helping us deal with media inquiries. But some of the stories that are running are upsetting and untrue, and we like to ask you all for your help in respecting Lo's privacy. We are just devastated at this turn of events and trying to come to terms with what it means, so please bear with us and know that we'll update you as soon as we can. Judah. Part 7. Chapter 29. She didn't come. The girl didn't come. The hours ticked past, blurring into each other, and I knew that somewhere on the other side of the metal coffin, people were talking and laughing and eating and drinking, while I lay here, unable to do anything except breathe and count down the seconds, minute by minute, hour by hour. Somewhere outside, the sun was rising and falling, the waves were lifting and rocking the hull, and life went on, while I sank into the darkness. I thought of Anne's body again, floating through the depths of the sea, and I thought with bitterness that she was lucky. At least it had been quick. One moment of suspicion, one blow to the head, and that was it. I was beginning to fear that for me, there would be no such mercy. I lay on the bed, hugging my knees to my chest, and I tried not to think about my hunger, about the pains that were gnawing in the pit of my stomach. My last meal had been breakfast on Thursday, and I thought at the least it must be late Friday now. I had a raging headache and stomach cramps, and when I stood to use the toilet, I felt weak and light-headed. The nasty little voice in the back of my head spoke, needling.
"What do you think it's like to starve to death? Think it's a peaceful way to go?"
I shut my eyes. 1, 2, 3, breathe in.
"It takes a long time. It'd be quicker if you could manage not to drink."
An image came into my mind. Myself, thin and white and cold, curled beneath the threadbare orange blanket. "I choose not to think about these images," I muttered. "I choose to think about..." I stopped. "What?"
"What?"
None of Barry's tutorials had focused on what happy images to choose when you were being held prisoner by a murderer. Was I supposed to think about my mum? About Judah? About everything I loved and held dear and was about to lose?
Insert happy image here, you little fucker, I whispered. But the place I was inserting it probably wasn't the one Barry had in mind.